This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
You're in the stage of extreme joy. That's great. By the way, it's the first of 10, so don't get too excited. And if you're like, well, I'm apparently in stage negative 17. I'm hoping to work my way up to negative 8 at some point. I feel ya. I used to just come to the Zendo and cry. Just filling up my hands with tears. It was hard. But I'm glad I did it. My own broken heart. Turns out that helps me to be with other broken hearts. And turns out all the hearts are broken. I have a topic I'm supposed to talk about here. So continuing talking about the flower ornament, flower garland, Huayan, Kegon, Huawu Sutra. I'm going to talk today, so there's kind of three most influential and central chapters of the text, the purifying practices, which we talked about yesterday, which is about bringing the aspiration that everyone be free to all kinds of simple daily activities. And sometimes I think in Zen, we're like, well, that's too complicated. What if we just do the activity with our whole being and that will express that vow? You don't have the extra of putting in the vow. You just bring your whole self to it. That's enough. Try that. I was picking up some chopsticks. I did it this morning. I picked up some chopsticks. Quite lovely. Don't do something with chopsticks. Complete. Anyway, so purifying practice, I talked about yesterday. We read some of it, and I'm going to talk about the 10 stages now. And my next two talks this afternoon and tomorrow morning will be about the Gandavyuha, culminating in focusing on the story of Maitreyani's practice. She's a girl, young girl, who teaches the practice of facing in all directions. That's what I'm going to talk about tomorrow morning. Anyway, today topic, 10 stages. Some people would say this is really the most influential of the sections of the sutra. And this is, I think, the only part of the sutra that's commonly referred to in Tibetan schools as well as East Asian ones, but I'm not really sure. And the 10 stages is just a couple hundred pages long. It's just a little nugget. So the 10th stage is a little hard for me to get into because I was trained there aren't any stages. So my teacher, Tim Burkett, is very into the Soto Zen no stages kind of mindset. And so, it takes a wonderful leap for me to be like, oh, what about stages? Those are great too. And of course, there are stages in Soto Zen. You could say when you take initiation, that's kind of a stage, or if there's ordination or transmission, those are stages in a certain sense. But regardless of what any of those things are, or what kind of amazing meditation experiences you've had, or wondrous realizations you've had in your practice, or awakenings, or openings, or Satori, we're here now. And that is pretty much all we really get. Interestingly, you don't really even get it because can you hold on to now? I could say, like, it seems like I can grasp a pencil right now. But actually, this does not bear analysis. This is actually why we have Buddhist philosophy, is to demonstrate why I can't hold this pencil or whatever it's called. That's a little bit of a digression, but ungraspable. Yes, ungraspable. Can be kind of nice. You put everything down, trying to be better, trying to be something you're not, trying to make other people something they're not. Trying to make something into something that it's not. You might think, well, but there's problems. That's why we have purifying practice. So even though you're not trying to make something that it's not, with the aspiration that everyone can be free, you can pick up a pair of chopsticks, you can pull a weed, you can call your senator, you can donate money. Make a sandwich and give it to somebody. No stages. Okay, so now that we know there are no stages, I'm going to talk about 10 stages. So the 10 stages sutra is really, if you weren't here yesterday, you missed my introduction of this sutra. It is definitely mind-boggling. So we start from the first stage is already unbelievably incredible. And then each one just gets a little bit more unbelievably incrediblier. Just long lists of fantastic and beautiful liberative qualities, compassion, wisdom, awareness, flowing naturally. Ah, very wonderful. So, sometimes people go, well, I just can't relate to this at all. You're just talking about these bodhisattvas and these incredible stages of awakening that seem remote from where I am. So I get that. This is what I would call an onward leading type of teaching. It's trying to help us see how limited we think we are by just kind of like having this image of something like so unlimited. And this message that it's like that is possible. It's possible for a bodhisattva. And if you've taken vows, or even if you've thought about it, if you've taken vows and didn't know you were doing it, if you said, I vow to free all beings, you count. You can't really be outside of the sphere of what a bodhisattva is, because to be a bodhisattva is to realize you're inseparable from everything. So it's like sort of, oh, other thing is possible. We think, yeah, I mean, it's cool to be like, we could have a higher marginal tax on the top 5% income earners in the United States. That is a great thing to think, in my opinion. Or we could even think like we could have some kind of complete transformation and people would share a lot more. But even that, like, what is beyond even that? Revolutionary movements in the course of human history have been so minute in how beautiful they think human can be, human beings can really be compared to what this sutra is talking about. And then they collapse into ideology. And I can say this text will relentlessly say, if you think it's a real thing, you're wrong. It's a Mahayana text. Things are empty, but there's possibility. So anyway, back to this theme that's trying to blow our minds pretty good. The tendency to present and use progression as a way of encouraging people to practice is a pervasive part of Buddhist culture. So the 10 stages sutra kind of starts from utterly incredible and goes very, very big, with every stage, including all the other stages. But if you look to the earliest layers of text, you have the four foundations of mindfulness, which is one of the central practice texts and the ideas. You begin by developing awareness of the breath. And as you become aware of the breath, it enables you to be aware of the whole body. And that is a foundation for how you live. You move through your life knowing your breath and your body. And with that foundation established, you realize the transience of the body so that you don't become attached to it. Because if you become really aware of your body, sometimes it's just a bunch of attachment. I'm just like, huh. What if I could be like, I know the body completely, but I know it's completely impermanent. All the things I do to just sort of get what I want don't really work. It's still first foundation of mindfulness. And then with that established, then we start to begin the ability to notice how we feel. And then once we know how we feel, we learn it with more subtlety and more precision, and we start to understand the characteristics of mind. And once those are established as part of our awareness, then we start to be aware of like the environment, as well as the Buddha Dharma. It's a progression. It's a progression. And you can find people who can teach you how to work through that, but they're not me. There's no training. That's wonderful. Or the jhanas, which are actually the most similar probably to the 10 stages, because both start with joy or bliss. And the jhanas, that's the eighth element of the Eightfold Path, is called samadhi, and it's always defined as the jhanas, which are then listed as a sequence of progressing deepening states, starting with blissfulness and then sort of shedding blissfulness and finding calm. And then you start to like not even have calm, it's just affectless space, and then like infinite space, infinite consciousness, neither perception nor non-perception. So that sounds like deepening stages. And the idea is people can do this. And there are people who teach the jhanas and teach people how to do it. It's cool. Jhana, by the way, is pronounced Zen in Japan. Deepening ethics. For people who are just learning the Buddhist path, they get the five precepts. Avoid taking life. Stealing, lying, intoxicating, and misusing sexuality. And for people who commit to the path, you get more and more elements of how to develop and deepen your way of embodying liberation through ethics. So, this idea that you can deepen is pretty cool, actually. I mean, you don't want to get in over your head and forget how wonderful you already are. I hope I never get in over my head and forget how wonderful you already are. I have no idea what my teacher, Tim Burkett, was doing. And I've asked him for a lot of instruction in how to support people one to one. And he says things like, I'm not really sure. But one thing that seems very evident is he doesn't spend a lot of time judging me. So, I'm just going to read you a little bit about the opening, from the opening of this 10 stages sutra. The intention of I'm gonna he clearly translates Bodhisattva every time as enlightening beings, which is weird. And I might just say Bodhisattva. The intention of Bodhisattvas, furthermore, is aroused and guided by great compassion, controlled by wisdom and knowledge, sustained by skill and means, stabilized by will and determination, Immeasurable is the power of Buddhas. Clearly distinguishing the power of sentient beings and the power of Buddha, focused on unfragmented knowledge in accord with spontaneous knowledge, completely receptive to the guidance of wisdom and knowledge of all Buddha's teachings. It is as ultimate as the cosmos, as enduring as space, abiding forever. With this arousing of the mind, the enlightening being is beyond the stage of mundane beings. Ah, come on, man. And they have entered the rank of bodhisattvas, is born in the family of the enlightened, cannot be slandered by any racial slur, has left all mundane paths and has entered the transmundane path. Here, standing on the stage of extreme joy of enlightening beings, one is filled with extreme joy, filled with calm, filled with happiness, filled with ebullience, filled with exaltation, filled with delight, greatly invigorated, most uncontentious, most harmless, and free from anger. Thus is the enlightening being extremely joyful when stationed in the enlightening being stage of joy. One becomes extremely joyful thinking of the Buddhas. And then it goes on. All the hundreds of times you feel super joyful. So, okay, this can be really a drag if you're having a horrible time. I've had so many horrible times. I can't even tell you. I mean, I could say it with kind of a smile because people, you know, it's part of life, but oh my goodness. So, yeah, sometimes it's like, oh, that's possible. Oh, hope. Hope is good. I think so. Sometimes just to be realize possibility of some freedom. If we get caught by hope, and then it's just I'm judging how I am, I'm judging what is, I'm judging this, then we're just caught. How can hope become just a gesture of opening? That's my question for you. So, this is reminding me, this like first stage is so joyful. Awesome. Wow. So it reminds me of a conversation I had with Judith Simmer Brown, who is, she's one of the founding faculty at Naropa Institute. She's a Tibetan Buddhist teacher and just an amazing person. And she just retired after like 45 years of being a major leader in the fields of integrating academic and embodied Buddhist practice. Anyway, she came up to do some teaching at our Zen Center a couple weeks ago. And afterwards, she was teaching Mahamudra, which is a Tibetan style I've studied and really love. And I said, I'm very confused because the Mahamudra people say there are realizations which are wonderful, very important, valuable, kind of like moving forward in the stages. And then there are experiences which are like, don't pay attention to that. And I was like, but I keep asking this teacher that I was working with, like, what is the distinction between the experience? How can you tell that you're not just having like a fancy experience that you're clinging to or a real realization? Well, it just seemed like a technical question. And I said, so, you know, what is the experience that's like the kind of like, no, she said, well, these experiences that we're trying not to cling to are bliss. bliss, clarity, and non-conceptuality. Which sounds like the whole reason I'd want to be on the path. I just had such a laugh. Why? So we don't get caught. So you don't have this moment, which can happen, where you're like, practice has brought me something so beautiful, so clear. Wow. So clear. Or like some blissfulness. And then it's like, oh, I've really got this dialed in. I got this sauce. I mean, I was like 2 years sober, sitting on my couch in my dingy little apartment. And I was like, I'm so happy. I literally was like, I never knew it was possible for human beings to be this happy. I was just sitting on my couch in the afternoon, looking out a window at a brick wall. Oh, so relieved, but not even relieved, just like, just there. 2 years later, I was in an emotional crisis that was crushing, crushing. Still doing all my recovery, but oh, like, where's my bliss? That's why I started practicing Zen. Anyway, if you are experiencing bliss, I suggest you enjoy it. That's my suggestion. So, because with the 10 stages, we say, yes, extreme joy can come through this practice. And then we keep going. Then, what got you to this practice? I was sitting with a young priest not long ago, and he was like, geez, I came to practice because I was just so overwhelmed, so many difficult things, didn't know what to do. And now it's like I feel stable. There's not like drama in my life. I'm just grounded. You know, I'm not trying to brag here, but I feel pretty good, just connected. And it's like, I don't have much energy to practice. The drive to practice often comes from anguish. The original impulse to practice in the Buddhist tradition comes from anguish. The 10 stages say great. Also, another great reason to practice is extreme joy. What another great reason to practice? And then, kind of like the jhanas. I don't actually remember the names of all the stages, and they're so unbelievably ornate that it's hard to distinguish them, frankly, for me. But anyway, with the jhanas, you start with joy, but things settle. Well, you can practice because you're settled. You can practice because you're serving. You can practice because you're in pain, however it is. But this sutra wants to start by saying, yeah, you don't only have to practice because it sucks. There could be other reasons. Oh, yes. I wanted to talk about joyful mind, Dogen Zenji. Now, Dogen Zenji is, I'm not really going to talk about this during this retreat, but you can find huge influence from this sutra, and in particular from the Huayan Buddhist tradition, which this sutra kind of spawned in his teachings. And I've given many talks about looking at the very clearly strong Huayan influence on the teachings of Dogen. And whenever you see him talking about, you know, your mind is trees, rocks and tiles preach the Dharma. Ooh, am I listening? Sometimes. So, here though, just talking about Dogen Zenji and joyful mind. So, Tenzo Kyokun, which tying back to purifying practices and doing each thing with your whole heart, the Tenzo Kyokun instructions of the cook by Dogen Zenji is really about how to do regular human activities as the activity of Bodhisattva. Very similar to the subject of yesterday, I think, if you recall back. And at the end of the Tenzo Kyokun, the instructions to the cook, he says, when you're cooking, you should invoke three kinds of mind. Three kinds of mind: joyful mind, parental mind, and big mind. And you know, parental mind is just like very caring. Big mind is basically non-dual awareness, which is the only kind of awareness you ever have. By the way, just because it seems dualistic doesn't mean it is. Anyway, so Here, I'm focusing on the first. So there's joyful mind, parental mind, big mind. Joyful mind, though, is how he starts. He says, when you're cooking, you should be cultivating joyful mind. And then he says, you should be joyful. This is kind of, you know, I generally will never say you should be joyful because people just feel how they feel. Telling them they should be something else isn't very nice. But sometimes it's kind of a twist. You should cultivate joyful mind. And then why should you be joyful, according to him? Because you get to cook for everybody. That's it. The reason you should be so happy is you get to cook for everybody. And as someone who's been Enzo many times, I can tell you every single moment I was joyful that I got to cook for everybody. Well, it turned out being that cook was a little closer to the four foundations of mindfulness. Oh, what's going on here? Oh, feelings! Feelings! Do I have time for feelings when I have to feed lots of people? Yes. Anyway, feeling joyful because you have the opportunity to give. There aren't any people anywhere who can't give something beneficial right now. You can't be outside of that equation. There's something you can do right now that's conducive to people being free from suffering. And it's always true. And isn't that amazing? Joyful mind. Now, it might be like what you can offer. Like, it would be weird if someone here just started swearing or something. So not doing that is giving something, right? So just like sitting here and being kind of attentive is arguably, I mean, you could be like, no, I think I should be interrupting you, Ben, and we can have that discussion. But sometimes like what we give is very small. It is millions of, or you can't count them, uncountable acts throughout the day that allows sentient beings to coexist on this planet that we don't even know we're doing. We're so used to them. They're so habituated. If we weren't like that, I mean, people could be killing each other all over the place all the time, or stealing each other's stuff, or yelling at each other. I mean, people do kill each other. They do steal each other's stuff. They do lie. But they don't do it way, way more than they do. Way more. Tiny acts of just making room for another person to pass on the sidewalk. So when we talk about the joy of being able to serve, it doesn't have to be like, yes, I have founded the new nonprofit that will transform the universe and cure cancer. That would be cool. You could do that. I'm just talking about bringing yourself to this moment and caring about what's here. That's an offering. And you can do it. And you can be joyful about it. And then guess what? You're in the stage of extreme joy. Well, I'm not really sure. I don't feel like sufficiently authorized to determine who is on any of these stages. That's not my field. All right. So I want to now do some reading of the text. And I think like it's very... I'm just interested in helping me see people see the various ways to read sutras in particular. So yesterday we did one where we just read and listened, and we made no attempt to analyze it or figure anything out about it. We just read it out loud and or listened. So that was it. And then we were done. And then we chanted, which was kind of similar in that we weren't spending any time trying to figure it out, or it just make the sounds together as a kind of a ritual activity of invoking the sutra. And then today what I want to do is something that I first perceived at a Gelugpa Tibetan monastery in Minneapolis, where they have like open practice time where people from the community can come in And you just sit down, there's a chant book, and people just sit down with a lectern in front of them. And then they just chant the text or they read the text. And everyone in the room is like, brruh, brruh, brruh. So it's a room full of people all like muttering to themselves. It's quite wonderful. So that's what I want to do is what I call muttering practice. So I'm going to tell you the reading in a minute, but the idea is you just sit and read the text out loud, quietly, without pausing or any particular attempt to analyze it. So again, kind of all the what we're doing this time, mostly just letting it sweep over us. So just read uninterruptedly. If you get to the end of the part of the text that I'm going to invite you to read, you can just flip to something from yesterday. I don't have the page numbers, but some of the previous material that could be that we didn't read because we actually didn't read a lot of it. So the purifying practices part, or from the very first pages, I think we only got like the third or fourth page. So the reading that I want to do today starts, the page number is 761, and I think it will be. Yeah, like the second or third page from the end of your thing. And I think what I want to do is start with just the verses. So it says, Venn Diamond Matrix spoke these verses describing this stage. And at this point, Diamond Matrix, who's teaching this sutra, that's a pretty cool name. Is teaching basically about the pivot between the sixth and seventh state. So, if your mind goes, I don't understand this, what's going on? You just read. Oh, that's amazing. Just read. Oh, I'm bored to death. Just read. So, we're practicing with the text. Is everyone ready? I'm going to ring a bell when it's time to stop. So just read what you read, and when you get to the end of the section, just find something from the earlier pages. If you could just push it over. Okay, enjoy. I'll start. With profound knowledge, following the trail of ultimate truth, mind stabilized to the sixth stage, hopefully concentrated, accompanying the journey of wisdom, and they enter the seventh stage of superior progress. Empty, timeless, wishful. Yet with compassion and kindness, songs of state, felicity, yet hungry for the endless virtue, while those at the end, they enter the realm of the world of great order and civic order, distinguishing the elements of affection and serve the world.
And
Thank you. That was very pleasant for me. I forgot to mention that that first stage, we were just reading about the sixth, moving into the seventh stage, the pivot. First stage is joy that comes from giving. So that's why connecting Donna and Dope. Anyway. That'd be nice to just see if people want to say anything, like if you have a question or if there was like something that in the reading that you just want to kind of reflect back out, something short. So reflections that are short are welcome, or questions. Questions don't have to be fancy.
What is non-origination?
Ah, so that's a fancy question. So that actually is kind of the pivot. The seventh stage is associated with the non-origination of phenomenon, which is that things don't actually come to be at all. It appears like there's not something, and then it comes to be, and then it goes away. But that's actually just a habit of mind that makes it look like that. Now, the philosophy that underlies that is a little bit dense. So the import of it, the reason of it, is if there are not things that are coming into being and passing away, there's nothing to grasp. So we're free from grasping. So the reason that it's worth learning to see how things don't originate is to be free from suffering. And it is very common in Mahayana literature to say one of the most important things bodhisattvas learn to do is be able to tolerate non-origination. In fact, last time I was here, Michael Newhall actually remembered the Sanskrit for this, which I can never remember. This is this term, which is like tolerating the non-origination of all phenomena, which is kind of like just seeing that there's nothing you can hold on to, which is a constant theme. We can deepen and deepen into that, seeing that our bodies are impermanent, seeing that the things we like always go away. That's one way of detaching. But I think at this moment, I'm not feeling possibly capable, but certainly not inclined to really unpack the philosophy of it. But if you're interested, read some Nagarjuna, for he says, not from itself, not from another, not from both, and not from either does anything ever arise. It's really the basis of Mahayana philosophy. Much less technical questions are also
this kind of goes back to your what you said earlier about not making your experience. And there's this line in here, reaching extinction of mind. Extinction of mind. I'm just hung up on that. And then it says, still, they do not make it their experience. And then the analogy is like having gone into the ocean on a steady faring ship, seeing all the water before them, and yet not being destroyed by it. I don't know what my question is necessarily, but that is a hard thought to fathom.
So you're noticing this is a theme of a couple of people noticing very philosophically complex implications of these teachings, which are very much there. And so this doesn't feel like the moment for philosophy. But this text comes from the mind-only tradition. It says we can realize that all the things we think are objects outside of ourselves are not. And then realize this doesn't mean there's some kind of giant subject in which everything has been included. But in fact, the subject itself, the mind, is also empty. Again, it's about being free. Because you get a little problem. I had one friend who said, yeah, I just sat zazen, I did a session, and I realized, oh, I am God. I was like, I mean, sure, as long as everyone else is.
I have completely the opposite feeling. As I was reading it, I wasn't taking anything hardly at all in. And it's partly because we're sharing here, and we were trying to, well, we're not talking at the same space pace. So I slowed down. So I was thinking about our pacing, and then it was pleasant when we were disjointed because we were then kind of in our own frame of whatever. And then I was just hearing everybody muttering, and it was lovely. I really enjoyed it. So for me, it wasn't anything about meaning at all. I really didn't take anything in.
Woo! Yay! Freedom! Thank you.
That's beautiful. How one can unbelievable variety with which people can experience what appears to be the same external object, all of which are not the same external or object ever.
On page 763, it says, being on the path, they do not act on afflictions. Could you comment on that?
Well, to me, I noticed that one when we were reading today. And the thing is, if you look at the structure of the Eightfold Path, you start with not doing the harmful things. Right speech, right action, right livelihood is about not engaging in harm. And then you get to right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, which are about transforming the inner stuff. So, of course, they end up looping on each other because I learned, like, oh, that thing I didn't know I was doing was harmful is harmful. But when there's an afflictive emotion, affliction just refers to an emotional state that's conducive to suffering or is suffering. And so, being like, I'm really angry, I'm still not going to yell at you. I'm really sad, but I'm still just going to get up and wash the dishes. I'm really anxious, but I'm still going to get out and show up for this person that I care about. It's basic. That's the simplest question I have. Well, I think it's actually supposed to be like time to joyfully eat lunch. Now, before we go, I just want to say, Oriyoki, how do you feel about Oriyoki? That's not really a question. But yeah, Oriyoki can be many things, but what about like joyfully receiving what is offered together to sustain lives in a beautiful way that's careful and calls our attention to the fact that we're living in Vow. I am really excited that I get to do that with you in about 10 minutes, so thank you.
May our intentions equally extend to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.